Hello, welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, with Cornell University professor Barry Strauss, military historian, expert in the ancient world, and best-selling author. During this podcast, Barry and his guests will share stories about fascinating and controversial people and events in history and myth. And now, Professor Barry Strauss.
The din of battle sounded across the rolling hills of southern Italy, where the armies of Rome and Carthage were locked in a death struggle outside the little town of Cannae. As the Roman legions marched steadily forward, the Carthaginians gritted their teeth and retreated, taking casualties as they went. Would they collapse under the Roman onslaught, or would they draw the enemy into a trap? Both sides' commanders led from the front. The Roman consul Paulus plunged into the thick of things, urging his infantry to crush the foe. His Carthaginian opponent faced him not far away in the center of the Carthaginian infantry line, positioned where he had been since the start of the fighting hours earlier. Hannibal of Carthage commanded his troops in person. Hannibal rode on horseback wearing a mail breastplate and a plumed helmet and carrying a round shield. His face was famous for its bright and fiery look. He had only one good eye, having lost the vision in his right eye to disease during a long, hard march a year earlier. The battle had reached its deciding moment. Just a little longer and the Carthaginians could spring their trap, knowing they would be hard-pressed to hold on against Rome's power. Aware of this, Hannibal rode among the soldiers, heartening and cheering on his men and even trading blows with the Roman enemy. If the risk he was taking didn't kill him, Hannibal would achieve a triumph. It was the afternoon of August 2nd, 216 BC. Welcome back to Antiquitas and our third season, which is focusing on great battles of Greece and Rome. Today, we shift to Rome. We begin with one of the greatest and most famous battles of all, Cannae. Before going further, well, how do you pronounce it? I admit that I have been inconsistent in the past. I have sometimes called it Cannae or Cannae. But today I'm going to opt for a third version, the way it was pronounced in classical Latin, Cannae. I hope I remember to be consistent. Cannae was the most dramatic battle so far in the second war between Rome and Carthage, what today we call the Second Punic War, 218 to 201 BC. This was a titanic struggle between two aggressive and ambitious military powers. Sorry for all those adjectives, but it's hard to avoid them. Rome is located in central Italy. By the 3rd century BC, Rome had gone from being a small local power to a giant that controlled the Italian peninsula. Rome's alliance system in Italy gave it access to a huge pool of manpower, the most reliable source of soldiers that the ancient world had ever known. Carthage, meanwhile, is located in North Africa, adjacent to the modern city of Tunis, the capital of Tunisia. Carthage, too, was a great power that controlled a land empire, in its case, a land empire in North Africa, with important colonies and bases in Sicily and Sardinia. Traditionally, Carthage was primarily a sea power, and Rome primarily a land power. But that changed in their first conflict, which we call the First Punic War, which took place between 264 and 241 BC, so a generation earlier, the war we're going to talk about today. The First Punic War was another all-out conflict, which was fought primarily in Sicily. After many turns and reverses, Rome won and drove Carthage out of Sicily, an island where Carthage had been present for centuries. Rome also destroyed Carthaginian sea power in this war, but there was an unintended consequence, and that was that Carthage became a great land power, which brings us to Hannibal. Hannibal, Carthage's most famous general, and one of the most famous generals of all history. Born in 247 BC, died in 183 BC. Hannibal, as a young man, took command of a colonial empire in Spain that had been founded by his father and expanded by his brother-in-law. Then Rome challenged his control. Rome and Carthage were blood enemies. Now, with the support of his home government in Carthage, Hannibal launched a war to defang Rome once and for all. He accomplished the spectacular feat of crossing the Alps in the snow with his army and his elephants, and he marched into Italy. There, Hannibal handed Rome its greatest battlefield defeats, including one of the most thorough victories in the annals of warfare, Cannae. He was, by his very nature, a truly marvelous man, says Polybius of Hannibal. A man with a personality suited by its original constitution to carry out anything that lies within human affairs. Hannibal was a man of extremes. His mind was quick and astute, but his body was indifferent to pain. He had a sense of humor and a violent temper. He was a man of honor, but his critics said he ignored his promises when it suited him, and they also said that he had a weakness for money. Polybius, the historian, was a Greek who had been taken hostage and brought to Rome, where he rose high in political and literary circles. Polybius is one of the great historians of the ancient world and one of our best sources for studying the wars between Rome and Carthage. We have other sources written in Greek and Latin, though none as good as Polybius. Unfortunately, there's not a single literary source for the wars that survives that was written in Punic, the language of Carthage. We are forced to rely on texts written by Carthage's enemies, the Romans, and by those who worked for the Romans, and they wrote in Greek and Latin. So this is a handicap in understanding the war, and we have to be, in a certain extent, we have to be detectives, piecing together what really happened and piecing together the Carthaginian point of view. Hannibal's bold and courageous heart yearned to carry out ambitious deeds. Physically imposing, he looked every inch the commander. He was born to be a leader of men, and he won the love and loyalty of his troops. People often ask whether Hannibal, who came from Africa, was black. The short answer is, we don't know. The ancient sources are not helpful. The Greeks and Romans were not racially enlightened, but they weren't particularly interested in race, so they rarely comment on it. The long answer is maybe. Maybe Hannibal was at least part black. The reason is that Carthage was settled by people who came from Tyre in what is today Lebanon. They were not black, but we do know that some members of the Carthaginian elite intermarried with Berber women, who were natives of North Africa and had darker skin. So we can speculate about Hannibal. Let's go back to Hannibal as a leader. Few generals have ever approached the battlefield as well-armed in force and fraud as Hannibal. Few have ever pulled off greater prodigies of mobility. Like the wigs and disguises that he put on to foil assassins, Hannibal was full of tricks. But he was also a deadly battlefield puncher. Hannibal's army consisted of a varied mix of men and abilities. Indeed, one of his greatest achievements was turning them into a cohesive whole. The Roman army in Hannibal's day consisted of citizen soldiers. Ordinary Roman males, most of them farmers, served their countries in the military. Fighting beside them were soldiers from allied cities in Italy, most of whom were also citizen soldiers. Carthage's army was totally different. Only some of the officers were Carthaginian. The troops represented other nationalities. Some were mercenaries, but most had been recruited from the various peoples in North Africa and Spain under Carthaginian rule. Some were inexperienced, but others had soldiered long enough to be considered professionals. Hannibal's best troops were Africans, Libyans, and Numidians. Numidia is what today roughly we'd call Algeria. Next came the Spaniards, and then Hannibal soon added to them Celts who came from northern Italy. As infantrymen, the best of these troops, the Libyans, rivaled Rome's famed legionaries, but they could not match their numbers. What really gave Hannibal the edge were his horsemen and his ability to maneuver. He used cavalry more successfully than any general since Alexander, a century earlier. Hannibal's father, Hamilcar Barca, had learned how to win battles from Greek military experts. His method was to hold the enemy in the center while enveloping him on the wings and even the rear. It was not an easy maneuver to carry out, but in the right hands, it could be devastating. Hannibal learned these tactics from his father, and he carried them out brilliantly. Hannibal commanded both heavy and light cavalry. Together, the two of them could run rings around the Roman cavalry.
Hannibal's cavalrymen were trained to fight in tandem with his infantrymen. Combined, they represented a deadly 1-2 punch. Since they were professionals, Hannibal's men had the training to carry out maneuvers that Rome's citizens could only dream of. Meanwhile, his elephants could protect Hannibal's flanks and terrify the enemy. The result was state-of-the-art military science. Alarmed by the growth of Carthaginian power in Spain under Hannibal, the Romans offered him an ultimatum in 219 BC, but Hannibal refused to back down. The Romans thought they could easily defeat him. They planned to launch 2 military expeditions, one to Spain, the other to Carthage's home territory in North Africa. Hannibal didn't have a fleet, so the Romans thought he'd be trapped in Spain. But Hannibal shocked them. He marched over 900 miles overland, across the Pyrenees, the Rhone River, and the Alps, and he launched an invasion of Italy, including 37 elephants. He proceeded to crush Roman army after Roman army in a series of dazzling battlefield victories. For a time, the Romans wised up and avoided battle with him altogether, preferring instead to harass his army. Then they changed course and decided to go back to the battlefield. Cannae was the result. I visited Cannae on a summer day some years ago. It was the kind of day when sensible people go to the beach, but there I was out under the hot southern Italian sun in late July. Crazy? Yeah, but no one who knows me would be surprised. Standing on the hill of Cannae, you get a splendid view of, green and well-irrigated fields in the valley of what is now a very narrow ribbon of river, the modern Alfanto River, the ancient Aufidus. What you see there is not particularly dramatic. You see a relatively flat plain, suitable ground for a battle. There are very few landmarks that are useful to the student of ancient military topography. But you know what? I learned something there that I would never have found in a book. I learned that at Cannae, you can smell the sea. The Adriatic is less than 10 miles away. I had imagined Cannae to be locked away inland, but in fact, it opens wider horizons to the visitor, or to the strategist. August 2, 216 BC, the day of the Battle of Cannae, was one of the most terrible days in human history. Nearly as many men died on that August day at Cannae as on an August day in Hiroshima 2,000 years later, and without gunpowder, let alone an atomic bomb. Hiroshima's casualties rose much higher over time because of radiation sickness. Swords, spears, slings, stones, horses' hoofs, the weight of thousands of marching feet on the fallen, heat stroke, exhaustion, terror, and even despair. These were death's tools at Cannae. Cannae was to Hannibal what the lever was to Archimedes. The Romans outnumbered Hannibal at Cannae by nearly 2-1, and they got to fight the battle when and where they wanted. And yet, Hannibal annihilated them. Hannibal, the victor, killed about 48,000 Romans and took about 20,000 prisoners. Only about 15,000 Romans escaped. The Romans killed between 6,000 and 8,000 of Hannibal's approximately 50,000 men. So the Romans lost about 75% of their army. A little more than half of them was killed, the other fourth was captured. The Carthaginians only lost about 10 to 15% of their army. It was one of the most lopsided victories of all time. Skeptics, then and now, have downplayed Hannibal's genius. They argue that he didn't win the battle, but rather the Romans lost it. There's some truth in this. Without Roman errors, Cannae would have been a Roman defeat, but not a disaster. Yet without Hannibal's brilliance, Cannae might have been a Roman victory. How did this explosive battle come about? Both the Romans and Hannibal wanted it. Hannibal was confident of his ability to win yet again, as he had done in earlier battles. Incited by Hannibal's provocation, the Romans threw out the policy of avoiding battle. In 217 BC, Hannibal teased like a wily matador, and his tricks drove an angry Roman bull to the point where it could no longer resist battle. The new consuls of 216 BC, Gaius Terentius Varro and Lucius Aemilius Paulus, broke with earlier policy. They would fight. and they would do so with a massive sledgehammer force, the largest army the Romans had ever raised, and the first one to be commanded by both consuls. Usually, each consul led a separate army. Although they were inexperienced, they expected to win through sheer force of numbers. They wanted a war-winning move. But that was in August. Earlier that spring and summer, another smaller Roman army had shadowed Hannibal. He made the Romans chase him. He drew them down from the hills in northern Apulia to the plain near the sea at Cannae. When he reached there, Hannibal might have thought about the blow that had already struck simply by seizing the citadel of Cannae. Rome had established a supply dump there, and its grain and other provisions now belonged to the Carthaginians. More important, Cannae had a strategic location. It's in cavalry country, and so it was perfect for Hannibal. Cannae sits in the valley of the Aufidus River, which flows from the far side of the Apennine Mountains all the way to the Adriatic Sea. The Aufidus Valley offers access across the Italian peninsula to the strategically important Bay of Naples on Italy's west coast. By seizing Cannae, Hannibal endangered one nearby Roman ally and threatened to open the road against others. Rome had to respond. And so Varro and Paulus brought their troops to Cannae. After joining up with a smaller Roman army already in the region, the Romans had about 86,000 fighting men. Hannibal had approximately 50,000. In its last stretch in the area around Cannae, the Aufidus River sweeps between two ranges of hills, and then, northeast of the citadel of Cannae, the hills drop away, the valley opens up, and there's a broad, slightly sloping plain that would have served well for the battle. Most historians locate the battlefield there, although a case can also be made for a site in the hollow between the hills. Before the day of battle, the two sides maneuvered. When they reached the vicinity of Cannae, the Romans probably encamped on the left bank of the River Aufidus. That's the north side of the River Aufidus. That's where the Romans were probably encamped. Hannibal is camped on the right bank, on the south side, at the foot of the citadel of Cannae. The Romans threatened Hannibal with a small camp on his side of the river, and then Hannibal responded by moving his camp across the river to the Roman side, on the left bank, on the north side. On August 1st, Hannibal challenged the Romans to fight, but they refused. Then, the next day, the Romans crossed the river again, and they took up Hannibal's challenge. How can we explain this elaborate game of chicken? One possible explanation is the Roman system of command, because the two consuls alternated the supreme command daily. The ancient sources say that Paulus, who commanded on August 1st, had decided not to risk a pitched battle against Hannibal, but Varro took command on August 2nd, and he took the plunge. Well, maybe, but more likely, the story is that the Romans wanted to fight on the right bank, where the terrain was slightly less favorable to cavalry, slightly less favorable to what the Carthaginians were good at. On the right bank, parts of the terrain lay on a gentle gradient, and parts offered less room to maneuver than on the left bank. Whatever the reason, shortly before dawn on August 2nd, that is shortly before 4:30 a.m. daylight time, the Roman consul Varro raised the red flag outside his tent, the traditional Roman signal for battle. Despite claims of tension in the sources, the other consul, Paulus, is likely to have cooperated fully. Rome had sent out its legions, and they had found the enemy. The day of battle had arrived. Immediately after sunrise, that is, 6 a.m. daylight time, Varro began leading the men out of both camps. He led the troops from the main camp across the river to the right bank, where the troops from the smaller Roman camp joined them. Hannibal climbed a low hill, and he watched the Romans arrange for a battle as his own forces prepared. The Romans left 10,000 men behind to garrison their main camp. So, 76,000 troops took the field for Rome. That is 70,000 infantry and 6,000 cavalry. To turn to the other side, Hannibal brought 50,000 fighting men to Cannae, 40,000 infantrymen, and 10,000 cavalrymen. He probably left a small number of his men in the rear to guard their camp from the Romans. Each side had been at Cannae long enough to reconnoiter the ground and make its plans for battle. Each side fought according to its ingrained way of war. Brutal simplicity marked the Roman plan. Hannibal's army moved with the cunning of a wrestler, who with a feigned glance or misleading hand movement tricks his opponent into mistaking the true direction of his attack. The Romans drew their infantry up in a conventional parallel formation. The Roman army faced south, with the Roman heavy cavalry anchored next to the river on the right wing. Allied heavy cavalry held the left wing. The Roman infantry was placed in the center, drawn up in a conventional parallel formation, but with one important and unusual detail. The unusual thing is this. The Romans grouped the companies of their army especially close together to make an infantry formation that was especially deep and narrow. Normally, the Romans would have a wider, more flexible formation, but on this occasion, they wanted to draw their men close together. The result was to create a virtual human battering ram aimed at the center of Hannibal's line. The especially condensed order of the troops also spoke to the Roman soldiers' inexperience. Because the Romans had raised such a huge army, much of it consisted of raw recruits. Perhaps the only way to keep order on the battlefield was to bunch them close together. The more experienced men were grouped in the center, providing a solid core, while the less experienced soldiers stood on the wings. The consul Varro commanded the left wing, while the other consul, Paulus, commanded the right wing. The two ex-consuls of the previous year commanded the center. The Roman infantry at Cannae was drawn up to a depth of between 50 and 75 ranks. The width of the infantry was about 1 to 1/4 miles, with the cavalry covering about another 1/2 mile, for a total of about 1.5 to 1.75 miles. Hannibal had far fewer men, but he had to cover the same frontage or risk having the enemy attack his flanks. The Roman generals were still thinking about the previous battle instead of focusing on new conditions, as they should have. They knew what had worked before, and they wanted to try it again, but to do it better. That is, they had broken through the Carthaginian center with their infantry in an earlier battle, and so they decided to stake everything at Cannae on breaking through the center with their infantry again. Against an ordinary opponent, that might have worked. But Hannibal had not let his understanding of tactics stand still. Unlike the Romans, Hannibal had learned something from history. In an earlier battle, Hannibal had been willing to sacrifice his center in order to win on the wings. At Cannae, Hannibal would also sacrifice his center, but not to win on the wings. Instead, he held his wings in reserve, and he had them turn inwards to strike the advancing Romans on their left flanks. It was a complicated and risky maneuver that only a professional army could carry out, with veteran soldiers in a solid network of subordinate officers. Unlike the Romans, Hannibal worked almost entirely with veterans. No new Africans or Spaniards had joined his army since the start of the war. Only the Celts could have provided new recruits, as they probably did. And the Celts came from northern Italy. Hannibal had added them as allies to his army when he invaded Italy in late 218 BC. At Cannae, Hannibal came up with a brilliant variation of past tactics. He organized his center in a crescent, billowing outward towards the enemy. He manned the center with infantrymen, Spaniards, and Celts. They made, an ancient writer says, quote, a strange and terrifying appearance, end quote, brandishing great swords and drawn up in alternate companies, the Celts bare-chested and the Spaniards wearing short, purple-bordered linen tunics. But good as they were not Hannibal's best troops. That honor went to the Libyans, who stood on the two wings. Experienced, loyal, and hard as stone, the Libyans also had the advantage of bearing state-of-the-art arms and armor, selected from among the loot from the 50,000 Roman troops killed or captured since Hannibal had crossed the Alps. The cavalry played a crucial role in Hannibal's plan. His heavy cavalry, who were Spaniards and Celts, stood on his left flank, near the river and opposite the Roman cavalry. His light cavalry, the Numidians, held his right flank. Hannibal and his brother Mago commanded the infantry center. One Hasdrubal, not Hannibal's brother of the same name, one Hasdrubal commanded the heavy cavalry on the left, while one Hanno led the light cavalry on the right. Maharbal commanded a reserve force of cavalry. Hannibal's army faced north. You might be wondering about the elephants. Where were the elephants at Cannae? Well, there weren't any. Although Hannibal had crossed the Alps with 37 elephants, and although they had played an important role in his first great battle, the Battle of the Trebia River in northern Italy, most of the elephants had died in the winter cold. Only one of them had survived, and he was gone now as well. So Hannibal fought his most famous battle at Cannae without his famous elephants. Let's turn to the morning of the battle. Probably around 9 or 10 a.m., the battle began. Ancient battles usually started with skirmishing by the light troops, and Cannae was no exception. The experienced Carthaginian slingers and javelin men got the better of the Romans. Then the survivors on either side withdrew into the ranks of the infantrymen, leaving a stunning sight, about 100,000 men on foot or horseback, poised to fight to the death. The most massive army of citizen soldiers that the world had ever seen was about to march into one of antiquity's two or three best professional armies. In the summer, the Apulian plain is hot and dry, and the marching of the men no doubt stirred up an enormous cloud of dust. The cavalry clashed first. Hasdrubal's heavy cavalry on the Carthaginian left wing charged the Roman cavalry. Cavalry battles in this period usually consisted of a series of charges and pursuits, with reserves pouring in to allow each side to reform and charge again, until finally the loser turned and fled. Not Cannae. Hemmed into a narrow space beside the river, the Roman cavalry tried to hold their ground, but the Carthaginians were more numerous, more experienced, better trained, and more confident. Many of the Roman horsemen dismounted and tried to fight on foot. It was a desperate move, leading Hannibal to comment that they might as well have handed themselves over to his men in chains. What was left of the Roman cavalry fled. On the Carthaginian right, the light cavalry under Hanno held its own against the Roman allied heavy cavalry. Suddenly, Hasdrubal's heavy cavalry appeared to help them. It seems that, after defeating the Roman heavy cavalry, they actually rode around the rear of the army, all the way around it, until they reached their comrades on the opposite wing. It was a prodigy of coordination and command. Remember how little communications these guys had with each other under the ancient conditions of battle. Anyhow, the allied cavalry, the Roman allied cavalry, broke and fled. At this point, the fact of the matter was that the Roman army no longer had any cavalry. For the Romans, Cannae was now an infantry battle entirely, and it was well underway. The cavalry protected the flanks of the infantry in an ancient battle, and the Romans no longer had this protection. While the cavalry clashed, the Roman legions had advanced. The Roman infantry pushed against the Celts and Spaniards in the center of the Carthaginian line. Vastly outnumbered, the Celts and Spaniards in turn retreated backwards carefully, changing their position from one of billowing outwards to curving inwards. As I stated earlier, Hannibal's entire battle plan depended on his lines bending without breaking. The Celts and Spaniards had to hold on long enough for his cavalry to neutralize Rome's horsemen, at which point the Libyan troops on the wings would spring into action. The Celts and Spaniards had to maintain an orderly fighting retreat while observing fellow soldiers dying all around them. Hannibal's casualty figures showed just how heavy a burden the center of his line bore. 4,000 of his 5,500 fallen infantrymen were Celts. The Celts had a famous love of battle, and that might have kept them on the field. But only professional training and seasoned officers could have maintained their order. That, and the presence of Hannibal himself among them, on horseback, and protected by a ring of bodyguards, but close enough to the front that he ran a risk. 9 out of 10 armies would never have been able to execute the maneuver. Most forces would have folded under a blow as hard as the one the Romans struck. Yet Hannibal's army not only bent without breaking, it then executed a series of counter-maneuvers that were as breathtaking as they were devastating. The Romans advanced so far against the enemy center that they marched alongside the two contingents of Libyans on their flanks. When that happened, and when the signal came that the Carthaginians had demolished the Roman cavalry, the Libyans got their order to spring into battle. They turned inward, and they marched against the enemy. With the Libyan front pressed against the Roman flanks, and with no cavalry to protect those flanks, the Romans were at their most vulnerable. On top of that, the Romans were tired. The Libyans were fresh. Still, what happened next was not preordained. If the Roman flanks had consisted of veteran troops, and if they had been well commanded, then at least some units might have been able to turn and punch their way through the Libyans. But the flanks were Romans' newest and least experienced legions. They probably panicked and fled toward the center, tripping up the more experienced troops there in turn. That best explains why the Roman push against the Carthaginian center ran out of steam, even though the Roman consul Paulus rode there from his place on the right wing in a vain attempt to rally his men. My colleague Philip Sabin, by the way, at King's College London, always emphasizes the importance of experience and having veteran troops in ancient armies, and what an advantage experience gives to armies. It can often be more important than sheer numbers. Anyhow, for the Libyans, what followed was, as one Roman writer says, butchery rather than battle. For the Romans trapped in Hannibal's vise, it was a foretaste of hell. Every sense was tormented. Sounds included horns and trumpets, war cries in a half dozen languages, the thud of tens of thousands of marching feet, the thunder of hoofbeats, the clash of iron, and the screams of the dying. Smells ranged from the slaughterhouse stink of bloody entrails or the more ordinary aroma of sweat, vomit, urine, and feces. The scorching heat of a midsummer day in southern Italy under the weight of arms and armor touched everyone and left a dry taste in the mouth. The dust churned up by the local south wind blinded some. Others had a clear sight of the field, so covered with blood and slippery corpses that just standing was difficult. And then there was Hasdrubal's cavalry. After coming to the aid of Hanno's men against the allied cavalry, they left the light cavalry to polish off what was left of the enemy horsemen. Now, in a move of extraordinary generalship, Hasdrubal had his men ride against the rear of the Roman infantry. Hasdrubal's horsemen charged the Romans again and again from several different directions. It was another blow to the enemy's morale. Had the Romans been more experienced and better led, they might have fought their way out here too, but they did not. With this move, the Carthaginians closed the ring. Between Celt and Spaniard infantrymen in front, Libyans on the wings, and Hasdrubal's cavalrymen in the rear, the Romans were surrounded. It was a complete envelopment, which makes Cannae a classic of the military art. Many have admired it, most famously the German general Schlieffen, who designed a new Cannae on a vast scale to surround the entire French army across hundreds of miles. Yet when Germany tried the plan in 1914, it failed. At Cannae, there were so many Roman dead, about 48,000 if not more, or a little more than half the Roman army. Some of them were still alive the next morning, when Carthaginian soldiers roamed the battlefield and slaughtered the wounded. Few battles in human history have produced anything like that amount of carnage. The roll call of the dead was a who's who of the Roman elite. It included 80 senators, or men eligible for membership in the Senate, 29 military tribunes, that is, to use our terms, colonels, numerous ex-consuls, including one of the consuls of the previous year, and finally, the consul Paulus, one of the two commanding officers of the Roman army. No names of Carthaginian casualties are recorded, but they may have included senior commanders, for if they were any good, senior officers would have risked their lives to lead their men, as many still do today. Cannae was a triumph for Hannibal. It demonstrates the many facets of his supremacy in battle, his tactical sophistication and refinement, his timing and rhythm, his mastery of deception, his knack of choosing the right officers and of holding them on the proper leash, loose enough to leave them the initiative, but tight enough so they followed his plan, and his skill as a morale builder for his entire army. Providence played a role as well. Hannibal conducted the battle like a symphony. As it turned out, not a note was out of tune. Cannae was Hannibal's greatest victory. It was also the bloodiest defeat in Roman history. Inexperienced citizen soldiers, it turned out to be no match for hardened professionals, led by a brilliant general. Amateur Roman armies had led a tiny city-state to the mastery of Italy and the central Mediterranean. But now, though, the Roman way of war was dead. As the sun went down on August 2, 216 BC, many might have wondered, was Rome itself finished? Not Publius Cornelius Scipio. This young military tribune, or colonel, was one of the few Roman soldiers to survive Cannae. He was one of about 15,000 out of 86,000 men to survive the battle. Like many of the Roman escapees, Scipio sought refuge at a nearby allied city that was on a defensible hill and loyal to Rome. There, Scipio rallied the wavering and faint of heart, promising them that Rome would rise again. Fate would give Scipio the chance to make good on that promise. And it gives us the opportunity to see just how Scipio did it in a battle that we'll be looking at in our next episode. I look forward to speaking to you again next time on Antiquitas. Please like us on iTunes, and if you are so moved, write a review.
Theme music by Lush Life.